Kia ora, welcome to episode 18 of The Good Oil, Conversations with Aotearoa Painters. In this episode, I visit Emily Hartley Scudder at her residency at the Francis Hodgkins Fellowship in Otipoti at the University of Otago. Emily graduated from the Islam School of Fine Arts at the University of Canterbury with a Bachelor of Fine Arts with First Class Honours in 2012. She has been the recipient of several scholarships and awards, and her work is held in numerous public and private collections, including the Christchurch Art Gallery Te Puna o Waifitu, the Hocken Collection, the Stevenson Collection, the Wellington City Council Art Collection, and the Gardner Family Collection. There are images of the works that we talk about on the Good Oil Emily Hartley Scudder Instagram post. In this episode, you'll hear Emily talk about the influence of film and film sets in her practice, the important role of photography for her, the fertile ground that bathrooms offer her to explore, her nod to the still life painting tradition, pushing back against what is the traditional colour palette in New Zealand painting, how she considers layering of paint as sculptural, and avocado-coloured baths. We started by talking about the influence of her grandmother and parents establishing early memories of making.
I think, like all kids, was, you know, really into drawing and colouring and all of that, and making cards for my parents and stuff like that. But I did spend a lot of time with my grandmother on holidays. She was in Rotorua, and she was a real maker, not a painter, but she was always knitting, always crafting, weaving, always finding things to do. And she really fostered that kind of making, and we'd always do crafts, and she'd get the colourful Fimo, so we'd make little kind of sculptures, and we'll probably talk about it, but in terms of miniatures, that was a huge part of my childhood. So I'd make little Fimo vegetables, and she'd make little felt hats for my Sylvanian families, and she kind of had a loom and wove some carpets for my doll's house, and actually even my dad made these little balsa wood vegetable crates, and I kind of started making furniture with balsa wood and stuff. So
there's quite a lot of art going on in the family.
Yeah. So my parents were both pretty creative, and my mum was in the film industry, and she was working on Hercules when we were in Auckland, and I think that had a huge impact on me as well, going into sets at a really early age. And she would take me into set, and I was really good at being quiet when action was called, but just seeing all these amazing sets, and I think that definitely kind of comes out in my work, these kind of environments that I create. So that was a really,
formative.
Yeah, I think so. And she was also really into theatre and was in amateur theatre companies. And I did a bit of acting too. I actually wanted to be an actress rather than an artist.
There was a brief acting career, is there not?
Yes, I did. Yes, I had a part on Hercules that I had to do a proper, you know, it wasn't just because my mum worked on it.
not nepotism.
Because she was a stand-in for everyone that wasn't Hercules, because he had his other stand-in. So she got to put on giant shoes at different heights to kind of match the different actors, and sometimes do off lines, sometimes do lines with the actors. And so she had lots of little roles, and then got me an audition, and I was an evil god kind of morphed into me to trick Hercules into killing another god. So I handed him a poisoned dart. So, yeah, that was my...
Wow, that's your 15 minutes of fame.
Yes.
Yeah, or at least in the film industry.
Yeah. As a 9-year-old.
Nice. Well, graduated at Islam, so University of Canterbury, in 2012. What was that journey, you know, beyond childhood to Islam?
I think I began kind of realising that I was better at painting and drawing, and you can kind of start, it was around intermediate school that you kind of realised that this is something that you were quite good at. You know, there was kind of a few people that were chosen to be in the kind of art extension class or whatever.
You.
And yeah. And then it was actually in third and fourth form I was being a little bit of a, I was kind of playing up a little bit and being a bit of a, I don't know, I kind of went through a phase of being a bit of a cheeky student, and I didn't really like my art teacher at the time and was just a bit, just being a bit of a little shit really. And which is a shame because obviously I, you know, still really loved art, but it was actually, a student teacher that started when I think I was in fourth form, Roz Cameron, who had, she studied at Ilam, and she was like, you have to continue to do art in fifth form, because that was when it became, you had to choose it, became
an
elective.
Even though you were making your life a nightmare.
Yeah, no. Well, I was making the main teacher's life a nightmare, student teacher was trying to convince us to, you know, the art was really good and we should, you know. Roz Cameron was kind of, was really great in terms of being like...
So push you through fifth form, sixth form, seventh form art.
Yeah, and she had gone to Ilam, and she actually did a trip with a few of the kind of, you know...
More promising students
when we were... Yeah, I think it was actually in seventh form maybe, just to see what things were like. And we did a little trip to Christchurch and went round Ilam, and she took us to some galleries, and we actually visited the Olivia Spencer Bauer studio, which was at the Art Centre at the time, and went through the painting studios at Ilam. And I remember seeing this woman that was just covered, and I think she was in jeans and a hoodie, and she was just covered in paint, and it was and it was all this kind of fleshy tone paint, kind of different kind of warm colours, and then her paintings were exactly the same. She was just kind of, she just blended in because she was just covered in paint. And I was like, oh wow, that's so good.
That is something to aspire to.
Yeah, yeah. And then we actually visited Jonathan Smart. And
your dealer now in Christchurch.
Yeah, yeah. And he did a bit of a spiel. And I just remember being like, man, I don't know, he's like getting a lot from this like abstract bit of art. Like, I'm like, is this like, I don't know. I was a little bit skeptical at the time because I didn't really know that much about, I don't know, abstract art. So it was like, I don't know, yeah. it was kind of like, yeah, I guess an introduction into that world in some ways. But yeah, I think really seeing those studios at Ilam and just imagining yourself there, that was a really, yeah, and I think, yeah, just seeing them covered in paint. And I think all of the artists that I'd looked at in books, like New Zealand artists, had gone through Ilam, so it was like, I guess, like the Bill Hammonds and Seraphine Picks, and so those were the ones in the books. So there was a few of my friends that were all really good at art, and we kind of thought, oh well, if you're going to go to art school, that's where you'd go. But we didn't really know anything about Ilam, or you know, it just kind of had this reputation. So but in retrospect, like, yeah, I don't know, perhaps Ilam's more, or going to Auckland is kind of more, sets you up for, I don't know.
Well, I don't know. There's a ton of successful New Zealand art practices built off Ilam.
I think so, but I think they...
Including your own, Emily.
Yeah, but there was definitely these golden years that they would definitely have still been kind of riding on in some ways.
Mm.
So it was definitely different from those golden years, I think. But
I don't know. I think of some artists that have come out of... Ilam recently, Chloe Summerhays, not least of all.
I'm
really impressed with. So did sculpture appear while you're at Ilam as well?
Yeah, it basically all started with the miniatures that I collected as a child that I mentioned earlier. And I'm terrible at throwing things away, as you probably...
we are sitting in your studio space, and there is, fair to say, a bit of stuff around.
So I actually got those out for a photography project at high school and re-photographed them. And I was looking at a lot of artists that constructed artificial scenes or miniatures or models and then photographed those that I really loved. So like David Leventhal and Laurie Simmons and these kind of constructed realities. And I realized that this was something that I'd kind of kept coming back to. And then we were trying to, I guess art school is about trying to work out what's some sort of a thread that's always been there and what are you interested in and what do you want to, you know, what's that thing?
So figuring out conceptually where you wanted the practice to go.
Yeah, or just what's something that you can hook onto and continue to explore. So, but I kind of realized at that time that there has been so many photographers that are exploring that realm. Like it's a very well-trodden path, really. So, and then I was majoring in painting, obviously. So I was like, how can I use this component of this? And then what happens if I translate these photographs into paint? And can I capture that feeling, that retain that kind of uncanny, or that feeling when you use a tool like photography to document something or to photograph something that is artificial, that is fake? And so that's kind of where it kind of started, that combination of supposedly a medium that captures the real, and then photographing something that, you know, bringing that into something that's fake and kind of that tension there. And so, yeah, so then I was basically went into painting to try and capture that somehow.
But you've always maintained, like, as I say, it feels like coming out of Ireland, you were fully formed as an artist. And the sculptural, so photography, painting, but the sculptural elements in terms of retaining those models. I mean, I'm not even sure, especially with early work, if sculpture is the right word we should be applying. Is it?
Yeah, I don't think early on it was necessarily. It was more, well, I was setting up these scenes and interiors in miniature and photographing them. So it was almost, I guess I didn't really necessarily consider them as sculpture at the time, because it was, they kind of existed just behind the camera.
They were simply models.
Yeah, they were kind of models. But then I did slowly start bringing in some of those miniatures, or having those alongside, just kind of putting them on a shelf or in the show as well. So they kind of slowly started coming out because they were such a important foundation, those found objects. And I did actually start also thinking about the environments that the paintings sat in as well. And even in terms of carpet, I did actually find, we managed to find this kind of faded pink carpet in a skip in Christchurch. And a couple of my friends, one of them had like a truck, and we kind of pulled it out and shoved it on her truck. And another friend had a roll of Axminster carpet that they were going to use for a sculpture, but I asked if I could use it first to put down during my exhibition.
So is this where, you know, more sculptural elements started appearing, when you started finding more and more objects?
Yeah, I think so. Like it.
Like, were they intended just as reference material originally, or were you like, oh, I could incorporate these into work?
Yeah, definitely reference material, but then I started playing around, I think it was in fourth year, I had put some carpet down in terms of my submission, and so you kind of step into a space, but it was still fairly minimal in terms of the installation. And then I also, in my postgrad year, did it, because we had some spare spaces, and we kind of did a little pop-up gallery. And I had, it was kind of split in two, and I had the kind of miniature version of like a still life, of a traditional still life. And then I did like a life-size version in the room next door. So we actually did real with real fruit, and managed to get couldn't find a lobster, but I got a crayfish head from a fish shop.
Yeah.
And then it was frozen, it started defrosting and dripping, and it stunk out the whole of the postgrad studios. So I was playing around with, I guess, scale, and I did also, that's right, for that show, there was a miniature, then there was a real life, then there was a photograph of the miniature, and then there was a painting. So I was really thinking about that process of removal.
Well, removal, but it also all remained.
And it all remained, and also, yeah, and I guess during the research I was doing at the time when I was writing the thesis, was about the original and the copy, and what, when the original becomes more desirable and when you don't know what the original is anymore, and that kind of whole simulacrum kind of Baudrillard, it's like,
well, yeah, it's now,
the hyper reality and all of that stuff, which has kind of still been there, but I've kind of then moved over from that, I guess. But just like, why is something that's fake, why is a miniature thing or a fake thing, why is that more interesting than the real thing, or why is a painting more interesting than the real thing? So in terms of representational painting, because I guess that's where I was focusing.
The sculptural elements are becoming like more and more elaborate. I'm assuming you're quite enjoying the luxury of being able to do that in public galleries. You're being given this, you know, bigger and bigger canvas, if you like, to work on.
Yep. Yeah, definitely. It's really amazing when you kind of get the taste of what you can do if you have a team kind of supporting you. Probably a moment where it kind of stepped up to another level was working with Dunedin Public Art Gallery and the curator Lauren Gutzel there, and making environments in response to eight of their collection works. And it was just incredible because I could kind of send the plans and be like, it was still informed by things that I found and also their collection works, but I was like, how about I get a chaise lounge made and covered in carpet, you know, and then I want this kind of bed that's just kind of an abstracted bed shape. And then they were able to just kind of help make it.
You have an installation, like an installation team now, as much as anything,
well,
just it sounds like.
It's only particular projects. So it is quite tricky because I get really excited about, I'm really thankful for my painting practice and kind of the grounding that provides. But I get really excited by the bathtubs and the sinks and the different things I find in the carpets. And having a space to be able to do that, like it's hard because you can't really do it in any other way, and you can only really realise it if you already have the gallery that's going to support you and that all locked in.
So those public galleries are really allowing you to explore something that you wouldn't be able to, say, in a dealer show.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely have pushed. There's definitely times that I've just, and especially earlier on, just tried to go all out, but with the help of my partner, Hamish Coleman, also an artist and enlisting family, and to kind of help. But it gets more and more unrealistic in terms of trying to do what, like a public gallery level show in a dealer gallery, for example.
Well, you say more and more unrealistic. I wonder if actually it's getting more realistic, because you seem to be being given greater and greater stages to work with.
Yeah, I think, well, definitely because I'm on the Francis Hodgkins Fellowship this year, it's a really amazing opportunity to get, because you do a large scale exhibition at the end of it, and because you're kind of the fellow, it's the team at the Hocken Collections, the pictures team, they're kind of supporting you and to do what you want. So it's whereas often if a curator comes to you, they have an idea and they have seen your work and they kind of want to present a certain direction of your work. So this is, I'm kind of really making the most of this opportunity because it's kind of completely just thinking of something that if I was to do a big solo project, what do I really want to make right now? It's exciting to kind of have that freedom.
So do you feel you're conducting through different practices? One that's, you know, public gallery installation and one that's, you know, more dealer focused, you know, a smaller scale?
Yeah, I guess you always have to be kind of aware of having components that can be taken away and taken to people's houses, for example.
Yeah.
So I do always still like kind of going all out in terms of, I may have a series of paintings, but I do still want to create like an environment that they sit in. So for example, my last, the show that I did most recently, which was at Jana Miller's gallery, we painted the walls and actually put tiles, well, artificial tiles down. And so it still ends up being quite a bit of work. And you kind of, I do love.
This is the, for listener reference, this is the Rinse and Repeat show. We'll include some photos on the Good Oil Instagram page of some work from that show.
So that was a nice way. I find the environments and installations that I create do create that that experience in person, but then there's those components of the paintings that then can be sold separately, if you will, you know. So it's a bit of a balance, but I have found with some of my the works that I want to make, sometimes I think of them as almost kind of condensed installations. So works that maybe just have a tile backing and maybe a kind of an ensuite shallow kind of sink that goes on the wall and then a painting above it. So they're kind of these things that you can take away anyway, they're kind of contained. And then even shrinking a bit further down for a few years, I was just really into kind of wall sculpture in some ways as well. And I was kind of trying to mesh in painting with that kind of sculptural component. So I would have kind of some foam or imitation foam tiles or cushions and then having taps or spouts or shower heads sticking out of those and then a kind of a painting set within them.
But you want to have the experience, it seems, for the viewer to be quite immersive, like for them to be able to walk, literally walk into an artwork.
Yeah, I really love that aspect, but then I also, it is quite nice shrinking down and shrinking down so then you can then go into the painting. So I guess I'm kind of grappling with that. I think I would love to be a sculptor, but I don't have
those. I think
those.
You are, Emily. I don't know if you've noticed.
I couldn't call myself necessarily because I guess that's...
Because you're using found objects, you mean.
Yeah. I guess I'm more... It's my way of being a sculptor without being able to actually make 3D things necessarily, you know, because I think my craft that I've spent a long time kind of perfecting, and also that going through Ilam did help that because it was that real focus on painting, and the critiques were just like, look at that, like, what is the painting doing, so I think it was a really good place to go to really have that deep dive into that medium, so I feel comfortable within that as my kind of craft. And then the other things I feel I'm slightly more, I mean, it's more exciting because I'm still a little bit unsure. I'm still working out what I'm doing with the ready-mades, for example. If I just have, there was two pink urinals in the show at Yana's. I think that maybe that's where painting is still very challenging, but I feel like adding in those other components are what kind of keeps me going. Whereas, of course, many people, you can do so many things on the canvas that there's enough there. But for me, I just like throwing all these other things in. I think it keeps things kind of challenging
for you, for you and
for me
the viewer
personally. Yeah. And then also, for example, in terms of pushing the boat out with the installation side of things, I did a show last year now, because it's the 3rd of January, with Heather Straka, who is a bit of a hero of mine, so it was really amazing to work with someone that I really admired, and I ended up creating the installations and the kind of environments for her painting to sit in, and that was an example of a...
This is, and for listener reference, this is at Jonathan Smart.
Wendy's Cigarette. Yes. That was definitely a challenge for a kind of a dealer gallery show, but we really wanted to...
Pretty elaborate installation
It was,
You've got a very patient dealer in Jonathan Smart, huh?
He's very trusting.
He's not even saying, Emily, can't you just put some paintings on the wall?
And I think also he had Heather's paintings as well, so we kind of, those could kind of be separated out in some ways. But yeah, that was a challenge in terms of the workload for the installation team. So we, again, had Hamish doing a lot, but we brought in Sam Clegg was amazingly helpful painting the walls. He's also an artist too. So you kind of have people to bring in, but ideally it's great having a curator and a exhibitions manager or something, because I find it at that late stage, if I'm also project managing too, but I'm also making the decisions if things change. That's almost a bit much.
Yeah.
To if people are coming to you, oh, well, what do I do next, Emily, in terms of managing the install? It's like, oh God, you know, like I'm kind of, it's a little, it was a little bit much for that time, I think. Especially because you don't have as much time often for a dealer gallery. You have like one or a couple of days to do the install. I mean, if I had, you don't want to drag it out too much, but for a lot of public galleries, they give it a long, you know, it's much more relaxed. Yeah. But
a word that kept coming to mind as I was researching for this conversation was facade. And I don't mean just, you know, place, but possibly ourselves as well. So, and I suppose especially because of the like thinking about bathroom spaces, which you've seen really fixated on in the last few years.
Yeah.
Well, I was wondering if that was, you know, as much about, you know, facade of our own vanity and grooming, you know, as humans, as much about anything else. So is that part of what the practice is about?
Yeah, I'd say so. I think also, I guess often it comes back to being in control of ourselves and our bodies and our environments, maybe. And I kind of am a bit of a, I'm quite a perfectionist in things. And I think how I repeat patterns and colours and materials and kind of envision this retro bathroom being ridiculously matching and kind of it definitely speaks to how we and how my, you know, myself tries to control our bodies or, you know, like it's definitely, yeah, it's definitely definitely part of it. And also just the wider societal pressures that that come from that. And I think even starting with toys, for example, got me really interested in different gender divisions and how kind of toys are often very gendered.
When you say starting with toys, just for listener reference.
Starting with the miniatures.
So starting with the miniatures in the first few years of your career, that led you to start thinking about gender politics almost by the...
Yeah. It's definitely, because it's always often kind of been there, and a lot of the artists that I was looking at were using toys in that way, or you know, or miniatures to kind of comment on how society tries to mold us into certain things from a very early age. So I think that's kind of always been there a bit, but then I've pushed, I guess I've kind of come at it with more and more of a kind of a feminist lens, I guess, and kind of a feminine lens in some ways. So it's inescapable when it's with toys often, but then it definitely feeds into what we do as, I guess, as adults in terms of in our everyday lives and those kind of the things that we do and to try and get it like a semblance of control of things, like whether and often that is kind of the material things that we surround ourselves with. So obviously, you know, it's definitely speaking to to consumerism and capitalism, of course. And
so is that part of the facade of the practice, you know, the promise of consumerism, offering the promise of renewal?
Definitely. It's
especially in bathrooms, right? This place where we go and renew ourselves start of each day
Definitely. And it's I guess that kind of advertising language in some ways. So I'm kind of using some of the, like a lot of my paintings, and they're often like the still lives as well. That's kind of have been a perfect genre to explore that as well, in terms of these things that we collect and kind of somehow how we choose who we are and form our personalities around objects. Or it's like, oh, you know, you could have the perfect life, or you know, if you buy this particular basin or hairdryer, or you know, it's kind of definitely tapping into that.
So you're where does film fit into the practice, either as inspiration or reference?
I mean I'm always kind of looking to films as well, and for example, in the show that I did with Heather earlier this year, we were looking at The Shining specifically. And obviously the sets are incredible. And I kind of replicated the elevator doors from the famous scene with the blood coming through. We didn't do the blood, but we just did the these twin elevators.
For listener reference, it's called Red Piazza.
And that was named after the carpet that is kind of a really classic Exminster carpet that you'll see still around in certain bars and stuff. It's probably one of the most recognisable Exminster carpet of a particular time period in New Zealand. So I kind of brought that in and kind of mashed that up against the shining elevator walls. But yeah, I mean, we can't, in terms of films, we can't escape talking about the Barbie movie, which obviously recently came out. So
rich material for you.
Yeah, so that was, gosh, I just wish, I wish the sets were just incredible. That's like basically my dream of making something like that. So I'm like, oh, you've done it. but yeah, incredible attention to detail and just that. Blowing up those houses.
Does Barbie bring us back to consumerism and beauty and how that overlaps in feminism? Because looking at your palette, you know, it's often quite pastel. And have wondered whether you're deliberately using a pastel as an outdated reference to, you know, how women, you know, should be. And I don't know, as I say, whether that is something you want to explore with the practice with feminism or a comment on.
Yeah, definitely. I think colour is a really, it's a really important component and significant, and I think maybe overlooked in terms of how meaningful it kind of can be. And I think in particular, it is changing now, but in terms of like New Zealand artwork as well, has always been quite dark and broody and colour. I think in particular maybe, yeah, Aotearoa, in terms of artists, didn't used to use a whole lot of colour, and because it was, it's not serious. And so I guess I'm definitely embracing it as kind of a challenge to kind of what's serious and what's masculine and what's, you know, proper artwork, or even in clothing or interior decor, it's kind of, those colours are, I guess, kind of outdated, but it's also bringing attention to the fact that everything is so boring and grey and reserved in terms of interiors, and where that comes from, I guess looking in terms of how fashions change and how taste changes, and I guess there's a lot of things that I'm looking at in terms of like taste and in class, I guess, as well, and how that's linked to consumerism. And yeah, and then, I mean, even just using pink, like it's definitely shifting now, because there's a lot of younger artists that are using bright colors, as kind of, for example, Claudia Kagachi is, mm-hmm. you know, there's just actually just super bold and just like, yeah, I'm gonna do these like massive paintings and textile works, and they're just these bright colors. So it definitely has shifted, but I think it's still making everything pink, or like it is still pretty loaded. And because it wasn't too long ago that John Key said that someone's red t-shirt was gay, or, you know, or like, you know, it's just ridiculous. I think maybe that's a New Zealand male thing too, this kind of like, oh, we can't wear pink. Or even a couple of years ago, we were buying like an adapter cord for a speaker, and the last one, I was in there with Hamish, and the guy was like, oh, you won't want this one because the last one's pink, so probably don't want that. It's like, it's just a color, you know. So but I do feel like it's definitely pink, like bright pink's like definitely been more embraced now, so I hope it's still interesting using it, because it's definitely still, I think it still has that potency in this weird, is it sexism? Is it, well, it's often can become, I guess, homophobia if people are wearing pink, or, yeah. So I kind of delved into the whole pink thing when I was on a residency in China, because I wanted to make a real, I guess, feminine and feminist kind of statement. But it didn't, in terms of how it was read there, colour is everywhere in places like China, and it is also super commercial too, because there would be shop fit outs that are just very color coordinated. One would be all yellow, one would be all pink, and these bright. So it is really interesting pulling out those things. And I guess in terms of pink, there's kind of like the pink tax, which in terms of products that you buy, like razors, if they're... There's a blue one for men, even if it's exactly the same, but it's pink, it'll be more expensive for women, or even different skincare or whatever. Often the branding and the kind of aesthetics around it, even though if it's the same actual face wash,
Is that why you've focused in on bathrooms so much? Because they're almost like a centre of facilitating that inequality between men and women. But in terms of expectations of beauty.
Yeah. I think the bathroom's just got... It's just like such a fertile ground for all of sort of so many conversations. And everyone has just different things to say about it. But it did actually... I think I was drawn to... kind of started with sinks. It was actually seeing a show, a retrospective by Robert Gober at MoMA when I was living in New York. And he had these amazing sculptural sinks, and it kind of stuck in my head that these are amazing sculptural objects, and he was using them in kind of a context of the AIDS epidemic and kind of cleanliness and all of that. And I think just sinks kind of stuck in my head a bit, and then it was making installations and kind of finding the ensuite ones and how that kind of they look like they could be in a doll's house because they're squished. But then it just ended up being a deep dive into all things bathroom, because they and actually when people would come to my studio when I had my whole row of different coloured pedestal basins out, it was really interesting to see the reactions of different people, and there were some people that were, well, often men that were pretty puzzled. They were just like, what are you doing? But then there was,
because they're looking at something I thought was tasteless or
just like, why you got a basin? You know, just I think maybe. But then there was.
I saw them more confusion around what the object was rather than the era.
Yeah, like
that it was
why I would be maybe interested in that. Well, that wasn't interesting to them perhaps. Because I think often you don't really need to think about. There's a lot of people that don't think about the bathroom at all. You know, it's just a space.
Pure utility.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But then there was a lot more of my studio mates that were women that were like, oh, that's so great. Like, oh, that's, I don't know. There was just a real. Quite a visceral response.
Translated to them a lot easier.
There was something there. Someone came through and they were like, oh gosh, they're giving me anxiety. It reminds me of when I was at a certain age, my mum took me into the bathroom and was like, all right, now you need to learn how to clean the bathroom. This is really important. Like, and, you know, got all the different cleaning products and was like, you know, now you're going to be cleaning the bathroom. That's your job. You know, like this is almost like a coming of age.
Like for the next 60 years, this is going to be your job.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Whereas you could kind of see the kind of puzzlement on some people's faces. So I kind of realised that it was really tapping into something. And
well, that's another word that has come to mind, again, looking at the practice, has been ambiguity. So, you know, looking at some of the bathroom scenes, not just the paintings that you're creating, it feels like there's a ton of ambiguity in them. So, like, for example, if I think about work like Germ-Free Adolescence or Petting Aggression, great title, by the way. you know, they're like this weird cross between a beauty salon, a bathroom display store, and a dominatrix dungeon. So you're deliberately wanting to play with those ambiguities of space.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. And I'm kind of on the edge of a lot of things, like in terms of am I critiquing the thing or celebrating it, or am I celebrating this kind of hyper consumerist or hyper femininity, or critiquing it, and like can you do both at the same time, and kind of that line, and kind of walking that tightrope rather than going too far either way. Or I think it was actually, I've been enjoying the conversations around the Barbie movie, for example, and interviews with Greta Gerwig, and because she is kind of doing that, so it's a similar, like she obviously loves Barbie and plastic, and as kind of I do, but she's also critiquing the thing. So it's, some people would argue that maybe you can't do the thing while critiquing the thing, but I think you have to do the thing to critique the thing at the same time.
Like prompts another question I had, which was, so, you know, the materials that you use, typically like 70s, 80s decor, and one might say garish decor.
Yeah.
I can't figure out with the work whether you are trying to make fun of it or whether there's a genuine nostalgia there.
Yeah.
Or if it's a bit of both. But
yeah. Yeah, I think it's definitely a bit of both.
Mm.
I also love using the things like the avocado bathroom suite, as you can see.
Yeah, well, again, sitting in your studio, there's an entire avocado coloured bath.
Yeah.
And actually,
it's one of the most common things that you do find because they're always discarded. And people love to hate it, you know, and it's just kind of like, oh, that was so disgusting. I can't believe people. Why was that a fashion, you know? So,
but you're not totally horrified by them.
No, I mean, I'm excited by it. I don't know. I guess it's that kind of collector's eye too. It's like, yeah, once you kind of start collecting something, it's like, you know. Also the resin, the kind of poured resin countertops. I guess I love that they're kind of trying to replicate like marble. Like it's kind of that imitation luxury as well. Like what's a luxury object? And what's the kind of more common version of it? And often some of them fade a little bit, like the pink ones fade and they go kind of a bit yellow and they look a little bit like ham, like cured ham. And so it's kind of that. And then that's kind of quite godly, you know,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah.
So I love those. I guess I love that tension, but I also really enjoy, yeah, I love kind of having the edge to it and that kind of creepiness or that kind of that it's going to bring up a different response in everyone. And then I do always try to find objects and use things, but I do also buy things new at times that are almost like replicas of the older things or some things to kind of supplement my installations. Or while I was on a residency in China, it just brought up a whole new use of materials in terms of these kind of fake foam tiles that you can kind of just shove over a wall without painting it or if it's cracked or and there was like these foam kind of almost like bricks and tiles and stuff. And that was just, I was like, this is how you make a life-size dollhouse, you know, so that aesthetic was like just so perfect. But it's obviously not good to be buying, you know, to, you know, but I guess I'm bringing it out of a different, I'm kind of putting it into a sphere where it's maybe valued in a different way as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, so because I was thinking about that with, you know, rinse and repeat. Obviously the bathroom reference is there again, but rinse and repeat, I was also wondering whether that is looking at objects and you know, re-elevating them or reinventing them, giving them a different platform than they've had before, especially when you're finding, you know, retro objects. So part of the practice as well, taking those older objects and turning them into literally collectibles, potentially for collectors.
Yeah, definitely. I think just that whole, the whole something that's like a item from, that's like from the $2 shop or something, and then elevating that into an artwork by, if it becomes ready-made, or then even further if it's then painted in oil paint, particularly if it's if I've spent a very long time, you know, if there's a lot of detail, it's kind of this absurdity to then to find these throwaway things and then kind of render them in paint. So that's a component that's always been there too. I guess those, that kind of high and low, yeah, what's kind of high art and then what's in taste, and it's kind of, yeah, that's definitely feeding into those ideas as well. So for a while, even just painting plastic containers, like sushi containers or different shapes. Yeah, it's elevating the objects and these kind of discardable objects and hopefully maybe making people look at them, take a second look, or I get, yeah, it's not...
Question consumerism.
Yeah, I mean, and I, but the thing is, I do, I do love plastic. Like it's an amazing material, and I love, it's all shiny and delicious. And
well, it's funny, right?
Colourful.
I guess it's only the last few years where we've started looking at plastic and going, oh, it's not the amazing invention we thought it was.
Exactly. So I can't say that I don't kind of love it in some ways, but then I think even just taking it and elevating it, and with these ordinary things that we just chuck away, if I've painted it and, you know, spent ages painting this plastic container, then maybe people will look at it in a different way and maybe value it slightly more, you know. So it's again, it's that fine line of using the thing and critiquing the thing, but also you don't want to I think leaving that ambiguity there is important as well, because as soon as it's too didactic, you might lose something perhaps.
So where does process start? Maybe we've talked about this a little bit already, but where does process start for you? Is it finding the right object as inspiration?
Or? It's often finding the object, or if I step back a bit further, it will be kind of the gallery space perhaps, and how I want to occupy that and what works will fit.
Whether it's dealer or public gallery?
Often... I guess I'm thinking more about the upcoming show at the Hocken. It's kind of how I'll fill the different spaces, and they have these kind of freestanding walls that I'm kind of going to be using as framing devices and kind of containing artworks on those walls. And then they also have mirrored two rooms at either end. So making one of those that you can step into, and the whole floor will be kind of in these amazing lino tiles, pink and purple lino tiles. So for that, it's kind of thinking about the space and then what works I can fit in. But I guess if it's talking more about an individual work or installation, it starts with the things that I find that I can't, the key things that can't change, and then how I respond to those, something that's gonna directly respond to that, often including that in the photograph. I think we talked about that. And then on that level, I kind of often think about the composition of the work. And for example, I'm actually painting on some shaped surfaces. So I'm actually getting a clamshell frame made. So the painting that I'm doing kind of fits into that clamshell shape.
By any chance, reflecting the clamshell basins that we're sitting across in your studio, right?
It's going to be... The clamshell show. It's called Splash Club, so there'll be a lot of clamshells. But so, for example, when I'm composing the photograph, I'm kind of grabbing objects and thinking about the shape that it's going to fit in and trying to respond to that. So some of the works that I was setting into the resin surrounds, they were all ovals. So kind of thinking about that oval, I'm going to do one that's kind of like a diamond shape. So something we'll need to... In terms of the composition, an object will kind of need to go up and maybe hang down.
So really directed or dictated by space.
Yeah.
The space that you're going into.
I guess space that I'm going into in terms of the objects, and then the space on the canvas that I'm then trying to fit the image into. So I have a very controlled kind of process. So I'm not like a painter that will just be able to start on the, not that much actually gets worked out on the canvas. It's all often worked out in the photography stage. And that's kind of the drawing process in some ways. It's kind of like changing the light, changing the different objects, seeing how things sit, then looking at it and kind of seeing and putting it in Photoshop to even just to put the border around it or see. It's great if I can get what I want in camera, but more recently I've been doing splashes and fast speed photography, which again is kind of coming back to the advertising visual language.
Looking at work at rinse and repeat, I was thinking, well, these have to be painted from reference photographs because the detail that you're capturing in those in the paintings.
Definitely, it's that frozen,
often
that you see in fizzy drink adverts or cosmetic adverts. So with those, it's a little bit trickier to get it in one go. So often you have to, it's a pretty rudimentary setup. So I'm kind of just chucking water at putting the camera on a timer and just chucking water down in front of, and then kind of it gets, you're like, just one more. And then the puddle is getting bigger and bigger and it's dripping off the table. But
photography then is still really central to what the painting is going to be. It's a really important part of the practice.
Definitely. It's a really big, really big tool. And I have in the past exhibited photographs.
Mm.
And for a while I was trying to explore how the painting sat next to the photographs and how that works in the same show, or does it work together?
So especially your show Fancy Goods, right?
Yes. Yep.
Photographic reference and then
So that one, multiple I actually paintings. Had them in the same space. Mm. And I was quite interested in that in earlier on in my practice. But it's still, there's quite a tension there. How do you, because if you're, they'll be competing. If you have the photograph and the painting, it's kind of, you can't escape that people will compare and compete, because I do paint in quite a realistic way. Like, I'm kind of referencing photorealism, but I'm not, it's not, you can tell that it's a painting, obviously. And also photorealism as a genre as well, they're often big blow-ups of, and you include every single detail. So it's kind of, there's the reference there as well.
Well, that photorealism piece, like you're technically, you're a phenomenal painter. Like, looking at the way you render metal surfaces and liquid especially, like, extraordinary technical painter, which is ironic that it's kind of the, you know, end, not afterthought, I suppose, but, you know, kind of end of the process for you.
Yeah.
Which came first? Were you always quite a talented painter, or have you had to refine those skills to create the work that you want to?
I guess I was always interested in really focusing in and kind of painting in that quite detailed way. Mm. But you kind of think you're kind of amazing when you're at high school, because there's only like a kind of a handful of kids that are on that same
that
kind of
good.
Level. Yeah, yeah, exactly. But then you turn up at art school and you're like, oh shit, this is everyone, you know. And then I was quite, when I started, I was like, I want to paint this interior of this miniature. I want to do it giant, like, you know, the size of Hamish's paintings, for example. And I kind of was like, I'll be able to do that. While I did kind of manage it, I kind of realized, I need to really practice at this to, like, if I really... It's probably not wise to just jump to doing this massive interior and you want it perfect, you know. So it definitely took me a while kind of practicing at painting in that way to kind of get...
So you've really refined
yeah.
as a painter.
Yeah, and I think definitely doing painting at art school kind of helped that, because it was that kind of deep focus on the medium. Mm. And I guess they kind of taught you that if you've decided that you want to make a certain type of work, like, you have to then put the time into, if that's making really, really skillful kind of detailed paintings, then that's what you need to work at.
There's a couple of works for listener reference again, which will be on the Good Oil Instagram page. If you look at Gush or Atomize from the Rinse and Repeat show, those are, I had to look at those very carefully to think, well, are these photographs I'm looking at, or are they photorealism painting? The latter. Yeah.
It seemed like quite a fun but also natural progression, especially looking at bathroom themed work, to then actually introduce liquid and water to it. Because even though I was using a lot of cleaning products in bathrooms and sinks, it was actually only in 2022 in a lot of those paintings there was liquid appearing. Some had appeared earlier on, but it was kind of, I love painting transparencies in glass, but it was kind of a bit of a moment where I was like, wow, why don't I actually, you know, include the liquid as another object that I'm painting?
Because all of those objects, if I include liquid as an object, liquid glass or crystal that you're painting, like, they're incredibly detailed. You enjoy that part of the practice? It looks painstaking.
Yeah, I think there's something really satisfying about it, because it is, I don't know, I guess I do get my kicks from, you know, you kind of painting something satisfying or that looks quite hard, and then you achieve it, and, you know, you kind of, I think that is something about representational painting in general, like, can I do this? Can I capture it?
Well, that maybe takes us back to photography. Like, why create that remove or step between the photograph and the painting? You know, why recreate?
It is, like, on a practical level, a really great tool to be able to use the camera as, like, kind of like a mediator in between, because painting from life is a completely different thing. But I think also it really does play into that process of removal and kind of that artificial nature of it's kind of, and it's funny because people are often like, oh, it's so realistic, and it is, it's realistic in terms of my paintings, it's realistic in a certain way, but I love that it's kind of, it's a different reality already when it becomes a photograph. It's kind of this photographed reality, which isn't actually real.
And then, of course, back to talking about original versus replica and the importance or value of those two different things.
So there's something interesting that happens with that step, and then also making it obvious that it's come from a photograph. So originally I was really playing around with the depth of field, especially when it was miniatures. I was really trying to be really sharp at the front and kind of really soft at the back to capture that.
Really strong depth of field.
So really shallow depth of field there and replicating that in paint so that you knew it was carrying, it was coming through a photographed reality as opposed to like something actually real. And then with the addition of like the fast speed photography, that's kind of capturing that as well, because you can't see that with your naked eye anyway. Yeah, so I mean, it's multiple things. It's practical tool, which is fantastic. And in terms of zooming in on those details too, it is helpful when it's already transferred into a two-dimensional medium for you to then replicate again in paint. So there's definitely,
Which that makes me like question, like, are you a still life painter then?
Oh yeah, I mean, that's another thing, I guess, because still life has often been from life, and it has been a educational tool and a really great way to teach how to paint, because you can set something up in the middle and off you go. So I guess that was also why I was interested in painting fake things as well, because still life kind of implies natural or kind of flowers or life, you know, something from life. So it's
still life is a tradition that you're curious to explore as part of the practice.
Yeah. So it definitely, especially earlier on, I was really, really focused on referencing that as a genre and kind of commenting on the different subgenres. There's the really everyday, which is kind of the bringing people down to the same level of kind of eating and drinking. And then there's the prompts to leave in, which is the hugely just ostentatious, like just getting all of the things that you've found in when you've conquered the world and kind of bringing all the finest china and the finest Persian rugs and everything
and putting
them all on one table, and this is my, so the still life is just perfect in terms of these are my possessions, this is who I am kind of thing. So it comes back to
the exception that of the figure was that these are all the things I found on Trade Me and secondhand stores
or had from a child, or
your own conquering
definitely. I guess it's perfect in terms of using it as a construction of self as well. And there is actually Frances Hodgkin's, I think it's Self-Portrait as a Still Life.
Yeah.
And actually Erica Van Zon made her response to that with fabric and kind of clay painted pieces. So it's interesting thinking about that, the works as characters or personas and as themselves. And that kind of came out in when I first started using pedestal sinks and corresponding tiles and then a painting, and I kind of named them as characters. So one was Lemon Lime Sweetheart and one was Tomboy Avocado, because that was the more butch one, or you know, in terms of the color scheme. So I guess that was also looking at different identities and different kind of
projections,
gender roles and different projections of characters or the people that we're pigeonholed into.
Like in your practice, how much do you consider yourself a painter? Given it's the last thing you've said that happens with any piece of work.
I think painting's
still really important.
It is still very, very important. I guess I think I still get the most maybe satisfaction, or I'm kind of the proudest of it, or if people are really looking at my work, it's kind of the painting that I guess is the most. Maybe you want the painting to be
despite everything else being, quite sculptural and, as I've said before, getting more and more elaborate, you still want the focus to be the painting.
I guess I want it to be viewed in multiple. You can kind of view it, take a step back, and then it's kind of like a series of stepping in and in, and then the painting is then that maybe final focus. And it is what takes me the amount of time, that kind of focused amount of time, and sometimes I'm like, oh man, I need to work out a way to make paintings faster, because it's, you know, you kind of look at other people and you're like, oh man, how did you do, you know, you can, obviously it's all very different, but I think there is that labor there. But I think, like I said, I'm probably the happiest in when I'm in the middle of a painting and you're like, and it's kind of revealing itself and you get to that point. And
so even though it's the final step, it's almost a crescendo of.
Yeah. And I guess when I say that it's the final step, I'll often always be working on it while planning, you know, so it's kind of, it's all the steps are kind of happening at the same time in some ways. And often when I'm painting, I'm working on multiple paintings at a time, with drying time, because it's all with oil paint. So, yeah. So that's the most efficient way. So yeah, even though there is this kind of process, it's still quite nice to always have paintings on the go as well. Because I feel like if I'm not painting, I don't know, the longer I leave it from painting, I start getting worried that I can't do it anymore. It's like this thing, you're only as good as the last painting you did.
Yeah.
And that's this weird drive. Maybe that's what
the work ethic.
Like, you just have to look back at paintings that I've done like a year ago and be like, oh, I don't know if I could do that again, or how did I manage that? Or you kind of, there's this anxiety there or something. So when you're in the middle of it, you're like, I don't know, there is this kind of satisfaction that you get, and then you take a photo of it at the end of the day and then go home and you kind of keep looking at it. It's like kind of, I don't know, it's a bit of a, you're kind of like, oh yeah, it's looking real good. You know, like you kind of, but then that wears off fairly quickly. Once you finish it and once it's there and you're like, oh, that was good. But
so you're always looking for the new high.
Yes, I think that's it. And I guess finding that perfect, you know, perfect bathtub, and then yeah, it is. I think that's why you keep going.
Yeah,
and also that not feeling like I'm, really achieving much if I'm not painting, or, yeah, there is something that's quite direct about it, because even though I do a lot of research and sit and edit photos on my laptop and all that, there is something about that immediacy when you're putting paint down. And it also does take, it is quite a laborious process in terms of carefully doing the layers and kind of building up. So in some ways it is a bit like sculpture, in the fact that often there'll be two or three layers on the object to get the perfect surface, and then coming in with the highlights at the end, and it is kind of like this building.
But you're working slower on that painting sculpture because of oil. So why oil is your preferred medium?
Oh, acrylic is just kind of terrifying. It just dries way too quick and you just waste so much paint. I don't know. As soon as I got to art school, they made us paint in oil for the first painting exercise.
Mm.
And then I've just kind of never turned back after that, because you just have so much more freedom. And I guess originally oil paint was developed to paint representational things as well. And often, because colour is so important, often I'm really matching colour if I'm replicating an object that will also physically be in the gallery. The colour's really important. So sometimes it takes a lot of time to mix that colour perfectly, and then also mix out the different shades of the colour for the particular object that's going to be in the painting.
The right avocado bath.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, you need the middle shade and then the lighter shades and the darker shades.
Yeah.
So then you can go and paint it.
And you just find oil easier to...
Well, yeah, because acrylic's just drying so quickly. And I know you can get mediums to slow it, but oil's just... In some ways, it would be a challenge to maybe speed me up in some ways, but you just have so much more control. And also in terms of the paint, you can kind of, you don't need to worry about covering it up, or like it'll last a few days, or you'll still be able to get under the skin a little bit if you need a little bit extra of that same color that you mixed up.
Yeah.
And it's just so great to, so you can kind of do all that work in terms of mixing the color and it's there and it's not immediately dry, you know? It's so, the times that I've used acrylic, it's so stressful. It's like, oh my God, it's drying, I'm going to, you know? Even I did the frames that I painted in the Jana Miller show luckily it wasn't too quick, but I was perfectly matching the colours and mixing an additive to make it like look like stucco, kind of dash. But I was a bit nervous when I was starting that because I just know how quickly it dries.
Oh, because so, you mean there were acrylics that you were painting the frames with?
The frames, yeah. Ah. So, but because it was going to be a bit more durable, so got golden paint for that. The acrylic was just going to, and also probably maybe a bit more vibrant. So, but yeah, no oil paint. I don't know. I just, and there's something, I mean, you can get really nice acrylics now. And even looking at, for example, Imogen Taylor's paintings, and I listened to her interview, which is fantastic. And her colours are just incredible and beautiful. Like,
and painting in acrylic is your point.
They're acrylic, but obviously she's using beautiful pigments and really high quality acrylic. Mm. And I wouldn't necessarily know they're acrylic, even though she talks about really loving acrylic. But they look like, I don't know, often that kind of depth and colour and deliciousness is kind of associated to oil, but I think maybe the main reason is because often if people see the acrylic, it's really shit acrylic, like you know, it's kind of the crappy stuff, or on a even just the supports are, I think also going to Ilam really made us into kind of material snobs as well. But I think it is so important, like, just if you paint it on a shitty canvas, like, it just immediately looks shit, you know, even if it's a good paint. Like, I don't know, there's certain things that you get real particular as a painter. Oil, do love the oil. Because it's nice. But there's more things that can kind of go wrong, but if you just keep it simple in terms of you have your linseed or and then the solvent and then the paint, rather than, I don't try and put too many other things in, anything that makes it dry too fast.
Light on the medium.
Yeah, just kind of using a mix I'm actually using safflower oil, which isn't as yellowing, but you do have to be careful with that because it doesn't harden as much. But because I'm using pre-mixed bought paint, it's already got
a bit of medium in it.
Going to be drying fine, and it's got that, hardener or whatever. So, and then, just like a little bit of solvent and kind of use that as you go. In saying that, I haven't looked at too many older paintings, and some of my art school paintings are, you know, cracking and doing weird things. So, but I feel like we're all allowed that. We didn't know what we were quite doing with oil paint. That is definitely a consideration when you're selling work, you know. And hopefully oil's going to last, but in case you chuck in, you know, mix too much medium in there and it starts doing something weird.
Yeah. All right, last question, which... Yes. I ask everyone. So removing any limit of budget or whether a work is held in a public institution, what work or artist work in general would you love to live with?
In terms of living with, there's...
question is open to interpretation, by the way.
In terms of living with, I think it would probably be a painting by, you could say like a Gerhard Richter or a Vermeer or, I don't know, there's some... the ones that you can just kind of get lost in and look at forever. But I did think I would actually say something a bit absurd. And when I was briefly living in New York for about a year and a half, I luckily got to catch the Jeff Koons retrospective. That was at, I think it was at the Whitney. And that was just, I don't know, it's his work. I mean, kind of people like love him or hate him, but as you probably guessed, I kind of love him in some ways, but he's also such a interesting character too. But the one of his works was this, a giant like kitten in like a sock hanging on a washing line, and it's kind of one of those classic like hang in there kitty things from like The Simpsons. There was a poster that said hang in there kitty. Anyway, it's huge, and this is just giant plastic kitten, giant toy, I guess.
That appeals to you in your practice.
And I think I was reading about it that he had to actually do all this research to find out how to make it, and it was actually had to go to a specific place that had to develop how to make it because it was the biggest plastic object made in one piece or something, it was actually really hard to make in a kind of a practical sense. So I just remember being like, oh,
So it'd be fascinating to spend more time around that.
But obviously, you know, crazy giant. He also had there was the giant pile of plasticine, but it all wasn't actually plasticine, but looked like giant plasticine. It was like a mountain. I don't know. Some of those, they're just, pretty, I don't know, I guess that love of plastic in some ways. But, maybe like an original kind of Laurie Simmons photograph from the 70s, which is in terms of someone that's really, as a starting point for my practice. Yeah. And she was photographing dolls' houses back then, so.
As always, thanks for listening. If you're in Dunedin, Emily's Francis Hodgkins Fellowship Show Splash Club is on at the Hocken Collection Uade Taoka Ohakena until the 18th of May. Emily is represented by Yana Millers in Wellington and Jonathan Smart Gallery in Ototahi. Thanks for listening. Please join me for episode 19 of The Good Oil. Until then, ka kite anō.